Hello and welcome to the Central Asian Podcast Majlis. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. In Central Asia, traditionally, some countries export oil, the others export migrant laborers for their economic survival. But over the past 1 year, price of oil declined by 75% and remittances went down by nearly 50%. A tough year waits for the region. Today in this panel, we plan to discuss elements triggering this setback and its impact on the ground. To discuss the subject, I have from London Alex Nice. He is the lead analyst focusing on Russia, Kazakhstan and Caucasus at the Economic Intelligence Unit. From Washington, D.C., Ned Schenken, project director for Nations in Transit at Freedom House. Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is joining me here in the studio. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having
you.
Very nice to have you. When we speak about Central Asia, usually we miss exact figures, statistics. But for this subject, we have plenty of them, and unfortunately, all of them indicator of yet worst to come. Here in the Majlis, in Bruce's Kishlak, we have been predicting this situation since last year when the decline in energy prices in Russian economy has started. Alex, let's start with you. Please paint us an umbrella picture of economic situation in Central Asia.
Well, as you said, it all really starts with the recession in Russia, which in itself starts with the fall in oil prices in the second half of 2014. As a result, in 2015, we've seen a serious recession in Russia, a contraction of just under 4%, and as you were saying in your introduction, a fall in remittances of around 40 to 50%, partly because the ruble is a lot weaker, so it buys you fewer dollars. But also because unemployment is rising, particularly in the informal sector and construction sector, areas where migrant labor is particularly dominant. And we've seen this reflected in a sharp slowdown in the economies of all the Central Asian states. Obviously, in the case of Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, big energy producers, then the impact of the fall in oil prices has been direct. And Kazakhstan, the government estimates it grew by, I think, 1.5% last year. We at the Economist Intelligence Unit think now that it will move into recession this year and contract for the first time since 1998. In the case of Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, then, of course, the picture is much less clear. We can't trust official statistics, but a lot of the anecdotal evidence we're seeing, given the demand for currency, the cuts in subsidies social payments, suggest that that there's also serious economic slowdown taking place in those economies. And then, as you were discussing, the remittance-dependence economies, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan to a certain extent, and Tajikistan, have also seen serious slowdown, a sharp fall in their currencies. In the case of Uzbekistan, then it looks like the black market rate is at its widest point from the that we've seen for a long time compared to the official rate. And in Tajikistan, then again, a crackdown, a big capital controls, they're making it very difficult for anyone to access hard currency. This is a real indication, I think, that the government itself is short of funds. And of course, you know, it's again, we're short of a lot of statistics, but we have to assume that there's been a sharp fall in household incomes and welfare across these regions.
Right. In Turkmenistan, ban was imposed on trading dollars recently. Nate, you had a very insightful piece on foreign policy published yesterday or before yesterday. How bad is the situation in Central Asia?
Yes, the article in Foreign Policy, A Perfect Storm in Central Asia, I certainly presented what some might say is a worst case kind of argument for what's happening in Central Asia. At the same time, and I try not to make it sound as if I'm relishing these economic problems, but I do think there is a lot of different factors converging right now to make for a very, very bleak year in 2016. And I think for those of us like you at Kishlak and on this podcast who've been following the economic situation in the region since the beginning of the Russian crisis and since the beginning of the oil price drop and have been saying that the economic situation in the region would get worse for us, what's been notable is that it keeps going down. And of course, the biggest driver in this is that the oil price keeps going down. But every month or every day almost, there's a new piece of bad news in almost every country in the region, if not every country. I say almost every country just because we probably don't get any news out of Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan every day. We might only get some once a week or really once a month in terms of quality news. So it's a very bleak scenario. I think the things that we don't know that might prove the situation to be more durable than it appears at times, or that I presented it in my article, the top one would be what is happening with remittances. We do now have estimates that are based, for instance, in my article, I based my estimates on what the Central Bank of Russia has been releasing and comparing the year-on-year numbers. Those are, like you said, they're somewhere in the 40% or depending on country, 60% range in terms of year-on-year drop. That tracks with what the World Bank was projecting in their estimates. But that said, we don't have great data on remittances. There's, of course, a very large informal remittance economy. There are ways that people can remit money that aren't going to be recorded in the Central Bank of Russia statistics or in other official statistics, for instance, by purchasing large consumer items like cars. So that's one area of uncertainty. It's also that, and Alex was mentioning this, that we don't have great statistics about household income or about welfare. That's an issue with remittances because remittances aren't taken into account directly into GDP. So when we talk about the GDP growth numbers, that's gross domestic product. Because remittances are money that are earned outside of the country, it doesn't count within a country's GDP, and we normally express it in terms of GDP equivalent. So when we say Tajikistan receives remittances of equal to 50% of GDP, we don't mean 50% of Tajikistan's GDP comes from remittances. We mean there's an additional 50% there somewhere coming from remittances. And so it's hard to say, it's hard to measure exactly when that and how that affects consumption in these very opaque economies. The other area of uncertainty, big uncertainty, and probably the biggest, I would say, is about who comes home in terms of migrants. You know, we know that there are millions of migrants in Russia, but again, we don't know how many. The Federal Migration Service, the FMS in Russia, records official migrants, and it releases statistics about the number of official migrants, and it is showing a drop. However, that number has always been far lower than what people think is the actual number of migrants. And so are people leaving, or are they going further underground?
In terms of number, Ned, you mentioned, I think this was in the Economic Intelligence report last week, that 4 out of 10 Tajik adult population is in Russia.
It's certainly possible. I mean, the numbers that you hear in terms of the number of migrants, so I think the Federal Migration Service has typically had numbers in the range of 2.5 to 3 million migrants in Russia, but the actual numbers are often thought to be 6 or 7 million or higher.
Right.
So we're really talking about a very large number, and that means that when so for instance, this month, when the Federal Migration Service says that the number of migrants has dropped dramatically, we really have to take it with a grain of salt. We also have to take it with a grain of salt because the that service in the Russian domestic political context may have incentives to present that information. Obviously, there's a lot of domestic pressure and a lot of domestic nationalism right now in Russia. Migrants are not popular. And certainly the government of Vladimir Putin would prefer to present an image that there are fewer migrants now, you know, that we're restricting this flow of people and that, you know, that we're going to give jobs to Russians. So it's tough. You know, all of these uncertainties make it really difficult, and we do kind of have to fumble around in the dark. But the stuff that we see and the stuff that Alex, you know, is doing a great job documenting as well, does indicate from a superficial level a lot of pretty severe economic problems, especially in terms of access to hard currency.
Yeah. These problems, Bruce, the ones Nate is mentioning, and also Alex mentioned in the reports that we have seen recently coming out from different sources, like decreased oil prices, decreased remittances, how this is translating locally in those countries?
I think you're starting to see some of the early cracks in the system. There's been strange social resistance activities that have popped up lately that seem to show that we're reaching the limits of the people's patience. One of the biggest ones, of course, was this, the homeowners protest in Kazakhstan last week, where everyone dressed in gray and demanded that they have their home, their mortgages recalculated so that they wouldn't be paying, they would pay their back their dollar rate, dollar loans at the rate of 183 tenge, which is what it, more or less what it was when they took out the loans, and not have to pay it back at the new rates that there were, that we're seeing. But the, but that was a fairly substantial size for of protesters. We've also seen Uzbekistan, strangely, and you don't see these things happen too much in Uzbekistan, but in the Fergana Valley, and I'm pretty sure it was Namangan just a month ago, they actually had people block all the roads coming into part of the town because they hadn't been getting gas supplies for a month. You know, in Uzbekistan, that's pretty drastic action for the people to take. So, we're and this, of course, is a result of the fact that the government simply doesn't have as much money. The Kazakh government used to support some of the housing programs out there. And the Uzbek government, it's unclear how much they supported gasification of the country and how many people actually got all the gas they wanted, or in some cases, any gas at all. But you know, here that was another example of where the Uzbek government doesn't seem to have been able to come through and supply what the people thought they should get as at least a minimum, and it turned out to be, you know, like I said, a protest where they actually blocked traffic coming into town. We've had, you know, Uzbekistan again, we've had multiple reports about wages going unpaid, and not just to factory workers, but government employees, bank employees. Turkmenistan, we saw, you know, the strike of the gas workers in eastern Turkmenistan last year up by Labap. And then, of course, we got this report that we still don't know much about where people actually in from Dashauz were, it seemed to have been a domestic dispute, but people actually attacked the police, which is something that we, you know, haven't heard of and coming out of Turkmenistan. So I think, you know, the fact that there are fewer jobs available, the fact that there's less money available, the prices are going up for everything, utilities, basic goods. We're starting to see some of the frustration from the people now. You know, generally, the governments in the region have been able to get away with infringing upon basic rights and stuff, but it's when they hit the basic subsistence that problems really start to emerge. That's been true for years and years. Now, in Uzbekistan's case, they've been able to patch it up much the way Kyrgyzstan for many, many years did, which was just by give the people what they want right now and end the problem. They did give the people in Namangan gas, so they stopped. But how you can't do that forever, you know. And all the governments, of course, are promising they have these great new job programs where they're going to create all these kind of all these jobs. But how are they going to do that? I remember years ago Uzbekistan said that we're going to create a million jobs, and what they did was force farmers to take on laborers that were returning migrant laborers from Russia and other places. And so the farmers lost out. Yeah, they did employ a lot of people, but it was at the expense of people who had to divvy up their profits among three or four other workers that they were forced to take. So we're seeing the start of social unrest. It's already, the evidence is there.
Yeah, I think I've seen this report from our Tajik colleagues that they were reporting in Tajikistan people already lost 40% of their buying power in the country. That's a huge number. So in terms of energy rich Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, their nature of their problem is different. But if this slowdown continues, what are the alternatives for people who are coming back from Russia or from whatever direction they are coming back, how they can cope with the situation? What are the potential alternatives? Alex, you want to jump in here?
Well, it's difficult to see any in the short term. I mean, one of the real problems for Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan is, and usually, you know, we're in a situation now where partly because there's just a lot of oil around, partly because of possibly a slowdown in China, you know, commodity prices are very low, oil prices are very low. That should be good for a poor, you know, non-commodity producing country like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. You know, food should be getting cheaper. Imports should be getting cheaper. But indirectly, they are actually highly dependent on oil prices. So they, in some ways, have the oil price dependence without the commodities themselves. So in the long run, I mean, diversifying, if Tajikistan, their main export, as you were saying, is going to remain labor, and it's hard to see how that will change in the near term, then potentially there could be some sort of diversification of you know, where migrants go, although that is very difficult as well, because obviously Russia is far more attractive because historic ties and also the kind of visa situation, however complicated it is for migrants to live in Russia, then it's probably nevertheless easier than, for example, going to the Middle East, let alone Europe or other parts of Asia. So, I mean, it's hard to see really what the response is, except, unfortunately, that you know they will experience a couple of years of real immiseration and a sharp fall in purchasing power and household wealth. And it's difficult to see how that will be resolved. In terms of the governments themselves, then there is leeway for to look for concessionary loans, either from Russia, from China, from international lenders potentially, and the whole games around the kind of resource diplomacy that takes place. There's still plenty of scope for that to go on. But for the people themselves, I think unfortunately, it's hard to be optimistic in the next couple of years about the outlook for the economy and for ordinary people.
Right. I'm just putting this as a deep note here. In Turkmenistan, it seems like government has no option. Recently, price of property and it is rent doubled in some areas of Ashgabat. And what we have witnessed later is like it become even more harder for people who are coming from outside of the capital to get job in Ashgabat. That is the one source of income for internal labor market in Turkmenistan. Nate, my other question is like decreasing oil price is not something new. And in the way the situation was developing in Russia, we could see that something is coming. And what happened? I mean, the governments in Central Asia failed to read the writings on the wall?
Well, I'll try to be generous to them a little bit. I mean, what's happened with the oil price since, I guess, summer 2014, right, which is when the crash really started, is being driven by factors that are not just economic. It is, to a large extent, because of a Saudi strategy to take the oil price down from below where it can be borne by other producers. And in doing so, the Saudi Arabia is taking that price down where even Saudi Arabia can bear it beyond their own limit because they feel they can hold it there longer. Basically, they're going to hold their breath underwater and hope that everyone else drowns and then they can resurface. And it'll hurt them, you know, they'll be in a lot of pain, just like you might be if you held your breath for 5 minutes, but maybe everyone else will be dead. And that's, you know, it's a really radical strategy, what Saudi Arabia is doing. And I'm not saying they're the only factor. There's, of course, other factors that are going into the oil price, but this is one of the biggest. And it's, you know, it's not just Central Asia that didn't believe that they would go this far. You know, if you go back to what professionals were saying about the oil price a year and a half ago, I think you'd not find very many of them who said we're going to go all the way down below $30 and we're going to stay there. So yes, it's true that particularly in terms of the currency issues, Kazakhstan was slower to react than they should have been. They definitely could have saved a lot of money. They could have prevented a lot of trade losses in terms of the relationship with Russia if they'd been more proactive and more forward-looking and just more realistic about what was going to happen and how long the oil price was going to stay down. In Turkmenistan's case, I mean, their currency policies, they still haven't fixed them.
And I don't know when they're going to. It seems utterly impossible that they're still sticking with just the one devaluation that they made now over a year ago. And this is a big, this is the big reason why they're having such dramatic currency, hard currency problems in Turkmenistan. Is they just, the value is way off now. And it's going to be extremely painful whenever that correction comes. But it's not going to be less painful by waiting. The longer you wait, the more painful it'll be. So, you know, they've been trying, I would say, to the best of their ability, in particular in the case of Kazakhstan. I think they were trying to make an honest appraisal of what was happening, but they were very much confined by the limits of certainly of their knowledge and of everyone's knowledge of the situation, but also by the political system and by the demands of the political system, which said, basically, we can't have policies that present a picture of uncertainty to the population. We need to show everybody that this situation is stable, that this is under control, and that's, you know, in a situation like this, when you're dependent on a single commodity, basically, for your budget, and that commodity's price has collapsed, you're not actually in control. And the only and pretending you're in control only reinforces, is only going to wind up showing that you're not in control. You really do have to be willing to be more flexible, which they've eventually, in Kazakhstan's case, kind of gradually gotten to in terms of how they're approaching the crisis by floating the currency. You're going to have to be more flexible, and you're going to have to allow a little bit more of adaptability. Is that going to solve it, though? I mean, it's not. You know, this is the thing that you rely on to fund your entire government budget, and that thing is worth, you know, a quarter of what it was worth 4 years ago or something. You know, you just don't have as much money, and this is where the longer term prognosis is pretty bleak. So let's say the oil price doesn't stay below $30 for more than a few months, but let's say it stays below 50 for 5 years. Then, you know, Kazakhstan has basically built up a state on the premise that oil is somewhere around $80 to $100 a barrel. Yeah. And they built up a state, and they built up a lot of infrastructure, and they've made a lot of promises based on that idea. And that idea doesn't match what's happening. And so there's some pretty severe, it's not just the short term. The short term is really scary, and that's what I wanted to focus on in my article, was the short term, you know, 2016 kind of crisis. But the medium term is also very worrisome. If you're the next generation of elites in Kazakhstan and you're going to have to figure out how this state is going to work, the premise that it was run on for the last 10 years may not hold for the next 10.
Right. Let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will be looking into how authorities are trying to deal with current reality and how effective are they and what the extended economic decline means for Central Asia and stability of a Central Asian regime. Stay tuned, please. Welcome back to the Majlis. Today we are discussing economic situation of Central Asia in the light of a drastic drop in energy prices and severe decline in remittances, a lifeline for Central Asian economy. Joining me in the studio is Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. From London, Alex Nice, regional analyst at the Economic Intelligence Unit, and Nat Shenkan, project director in Nations in Transit at Freedom House. I am Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Nate, your organization has just released its annual report on freedom in the world. Not surprisingly, Central Asia remains at the bottom, especially Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan is closely following these two countries with a reputation of cracking down on freedom. Is there any connection between the decline in economic sources in heightening pressure on civil societies in those countries?
Yes, I would say there is. This certainly the trends have been going on for a very long time, and Central Asia has been, with the slight exception of Kyrgyzstan, has been one of, if not the worst region in the world in terms of democratic performance for quite some time. And, of course, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan have really led the charge in that, being two of the most repressive countries in the world. But in 2015, yes, there's been kind of sharpening of the knives. I would say in Tajikistan, which is the most fragile, in my opinion, in this current economic crisis, the most fragile of the five countries. In Tajikistan in particular, there's a very severe crackdown in 2015, defined especially by the banning of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, the IRPT, that happened after the IRPT was essentially pushed out of parliament entirely in fraudulent elections, even more fraudulent than usual. And the IRPT has now been declared an extremist organization. Its leader has left the country and remains outside of the country in exile. Its top leadership has been arrested and are being held basically incommunicado. Its members are under severe threat within the country. There's a very widespread crackdown, and we also see at the same time, as we saw this morning, more and more indications that the president's family is going to consolidate all authority within his family and within his clique. And so the appointment of his daughter this morning, or the announcement of the appointment that his daughter would head the presidential administration, I'm very impressed at her upward mobility. She's only 2 years older than I am, and already running the presidential administration of a country. So yes, I think in Tajikistan, that's certainly the most extreme case in terms of a crackdown. I would point also, because it's a more exceptional, also to a very worrying situation in Kyrgyzstan. Certainly, Kyrgyzstan remains considerably freer than the other four countries. They did hold elections in 2015 that were very much a mixed bag, but by the compared to the rest of the region, were pluralist, let's say. Let's not say free or fair, but they were pluralist and they were competitive. That said, there's been a lot of aggressive moves within Kyrgyzstan against Uzbeks in the south, the prosecution of a very prominent imam from southern Uzbekistan, Rashad Kamalov. There's also been these kind of very unusual incidents of anti-terrorist units having firefights in the center of Bishkek or in other parts of the capital that they blame on conflict with Islamic State cells, which people who are very immersed in the questions of jihadism in Central Asia find extremely unlikely. These look more like typical criminal incidents rather than terrorist incidents, but the government very quickly presents them as terrorist incidents. You also have things like the blacklisting of Mira Ritman, the Human Rights Watch researcher in Kyrgyzstan, who is, has now been refused entry to the country and is being told that she can't return. This happened in December. There's worrying signs in Kyrgyzstan, I would say. Those as well have been building. Those, I would definitely say, started in 2014. But there are worrying signs in Kyrgyzstan that the government, and that in particular the security services, the GIK and the in Kyrgyzstan, are very keen to return to some of their traditional practices.
Right. You mentioned, Nate, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and to some extent Uzbekistan. I just want to add here a few points about Turkmenistan pressure against our reporters in Turkmenistan, as we believe, certainly has to do with the economic performance of Turkmen authorities. So the example is whenever they would, our reporters would file a report critical of the country, the next day he or she would be called to the relevant office and for quote-unquote consultation. Alex, I'm coming to you. The way authorities failed to read the writings on the wall about the upcoming economic decline, with intensifying their pressure against, in case of Tajikistan, the Islamic Party, and the in case of Turkmenistan, against the journalists, they are again on the wrong direction to deal with this crisis?
Yes, I mean, I think you're right, but it's difficult for them to respond in other ways. I think the other interesting trend before coming to that we've seen over the last couple of years, and Nate has talked about in the past, is sort of authoritarian learning. We've seen that that legislation which has been adopted in Russia in response to the kind of authoritarian conservative turn we've seen since 2012 there has started to creep into the discourse and then the legislation in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. So discussion about laws on foreign agents or laws against the LGBT community and so forth. In terms of the policy response, I mean, clearly the challenge for these regimes is well, how do you legitimate or how do you maintain stay in power in a situation where growth is slowing? Kazakhstan for me is an interesting case because it's always been an outlier in the sense that at least officially they have positioned the government has positioned itself as a sort of developmental state, you know, a modernizing state, one where in 10 years' time your wealth and your standard of living will be higher than it was 10 years ago, and there are all these sort of government plans. And actually, since the crisis, Nazarbayev has doubled down on that. True, there has been the shift to building up a sense of national identity and of course, the celebrations of 550 years of the Kazakh state last year. But, you know, nevertheless, they're still talking about how this is an opportunity to actually modernize and to reform and liberalize, which is interesting, I think, and could in itself, I think, pose the challenges in the future. But I think it's, in the case of Kazakhstan, somewhat reassuring that the discourse hasn't shifted more to one about stability, security, you know, as the kind of justification for the regime, and still the sort of welfare aspect remains important. But obviously, as Nate was outlining, you're outlining in other countries in the region, that's much less the case. Tajikistan in particular, we've seen simply that the response to the kind of threat of destabilization from the economic slowdown is one of more force and trying to strengthen the regime both within by pushing out potential threats from within the government and the state, and also between the state and the population.
Alex, you point out a very interesting point. Bruce, just before the discussion, we have been talking about the impact of the declining oil price or the decreased remittances and unemployment and all this stuff. How much damage does it causing to the states, and what does it say if it continues for a long time? What does it say about the stability of those regimes?
I think a lot of people over this year are going to have to reevaluate their image of their own governments. Things were going, people, when we were talking about this, I made the point because I was there in the 90s. So I remember there was a lot of confusion, there was great economic chaos and stuff, but no one had ever been through it before. So it was new for everybody, for the people and the governments at the same time. And there was, this feeling of like, well, okay, we're independent countries, so we just got to kind of play along with this, and it'll all shake itself out, and everything will turn out all right. And to a great extent, it kind of did. I mean, at least things got stable, and the best case scenario was Kazakhstan, where the standard of living actually did improve very noticeably over a period of more than a decade. But we're coming back to the same kind of problems that we saw in the 90s, and now there's not so much of a, there's not any reason why the people should feel that they need to be patient with this kind of stuff anymore, because they have been through it before, and now all these countries are turning 25 years old this year. So it's rough to all of a sudden realize that, all the promises your governments had made and all the slow and small gains that you'd achieved, over the course of these years are all crumbling around the people, and the governments will again say, it's not our fault, and as Nate made mm-hmm. the point that it, to a large extent, it's not their fault. So, but I wonder how receptive the people are going to be for some of that. And if I could just throw in one comment, since we're talking about how this year is going to go, it's not even just a question of political opponents of the government. They're Central Asian governments, some of them have had it down for a long time, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, but what they don't want is criticism of their system coming from within the country. Yeah. Kazakhstan and Tajikistan have moved very quickly to to stamp out any potential critics of the government. You know, we've seen, as Nate rightly described it, a purge in Tajikistan, essentially. And Kazakhstan hasn't been any slower with doing this stuff either. They've tightened laws so that anyone who criticizes the government, you know, in Kazakhstan, for instance, now they have this clause about insulting the honor of the nation. You know, what does that mean exactly? You know, how do you define that? So they're it's an old game where first you say, look, anyone that can criticize the government, we're gonna quiet them up, we're gonna shut them up immediately, and then we'll play the distraction game. And we do that, you know this from Turkmenistan, yeah. You know, don't look at your bad economic situation, look at the great monument or festival that we're gonna have instead, and we'll promise you that things are gonna get better soon. Don't worry about it. You know, so it's an old game, and certainly the people of Central Asia know it's an old game too.
Yeah.
So I'm real curious to see how this works its way through the year, because the same old promises they made 20 years ago that seem to mollify the people, I don't think are going to work this time.
Right.
And I also wonder with their usual policy of if there's any hint of criticism, we'll just, you know, root that person out, throw them in jail, chase them out of the country, whatever. I don't think that's going to work so well this time either, because people have seen that one too.
No. Fascinating thoughts, Bruce. Unfortunately, I need to wrap up the discussion here, but last points, and that's it. This is a dangerous game of prediction here. Nate, how you go? Things are developing until, let's say, December this year in the region.
Well, yeah, dangerous game, like you said, and I'm always loath to make predictions.
Yeah.
I'll caveat everything. It really depends on the oil price, and it depends on what happens with Russia's economy. So a couple of things that can turn things around for the region would be, of course, if the oil price somehow reverses course. And even if it came back up to, you know, let's say 60, 50 or 60, you'd have a very, a much more stable position. Of course, if Russia is able to get its sanctions lifted, that won't overcome the oil price effect, but it would probably provide a boost to their economy as investments started to return and as in general the mood improved. And I think it would help the financial sector. So you might see a less dire scenario for Russia.
Right. I'm not. Yeah. Go on.
So the actual predictions, though. I mean, I think Tajikistan is the most fragile of these countries. I think it is the one where the economic situation is very bleak and is worse than it appears. Just in the, I think it's worse than it looks in the statistics. And I think the fact that their national bank has stopped releasing information about what its reserves are is very disturbing. That's been happening for months that they haven't released them. And I think the remittance question there, obviously the remittance dependency is even higher in Tajikistan than it is anywhere else. And they are the most fragile. And of course, the government has been really actively consolidating its authority within essentially a single family. And Tajikistan has a history of other regions that are excluded from that deal rising up and fighting, you know, engaging in conflict with the center when they're not happy with the deal. And so I think Tajikistan's in a really dire state. I'm sure the government sees the same picture and is saying that's why we're going to consolidate even more aggressively. So that's the one I worry about the most for 2016.
Right. I'm not certainly expert on this subject, but improvement in Russian economy depends on oil price. It looks like it's not going to be better soon. And you also know, Alex, better than me, that Iran is coming into the market, and it's certainly going to even, you know, push the prices down further. So what is your prediction in upcoming 11 months in Central Asia?
Economically, well, I mean, I guess I think we're looking with oil prices around this level, and, you know, the World Bank cut their forecast yesterday just to $37 a barrel, not much higher than where we are right now. At that area, you're looking at the second year of contraction in Russia, and so even a worsening, you know, we could see even a further fall in remittances to some of these countries. And I think for the oil producers, then in Kazakhstan, for me, the real thing to watch is the one of the major concerns since Janaozen in Kazakhstan has been about unemployment in single industry towns, and we're seeing reports now that, you know, KMG is lobbying the government saying, can you please cut taxes on oil production because we cannot afford to produce at this level. And My suspicion is that, in fact, one of the reasons why they eventually did devalue is that the commodity producers simply said, well, you know, either you devalue and cut our costs or we're going to have mass unemployment. So that is a real concern, and you know, you could see trouble there again. I agree with Nate that you have, in Tajikistan, you have a very, very fragile state that's under serious pressure and is responding with ever more oppressive means, and it's difficult to make firm predictions in that kind of context and a fairly opaque political system, but clearly the potential for very unexpected and very unpleasant outcomes has risen. Across the region, the potential for social unrest, I think, has gone up. Having said that, I wonder whether in some ways, you know, for the regimes themselves, the risk of conflict within the regime may not rise so much, because one of the effects of the devaluation is that control of commodity exports and of the reserves in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, where you have them, actually becomes even more salient. So the groups that have control of those have become more powerful relative to the rest. Mm. And so in some ways, perhaps, you know, because the other big question is about elite coherence and whether these, you know, regimes will hold together. But in the case of devaluation, then I wonder whether actually, with the pressure they're under, we could actually see a sort of consolidation rather than a fragmentation.
Right. You know, Nathan, Alex, both of you spoke about the policy level. Bruce, Alex also said, if you paid attention, that potential social unrest is grown. So when you make your prediction, please tell us about what are your expectations in terms of social disorder in those countries going forward in upcoming 11 months if this crisis continues the way it has.
Of course, the economic situation isn't going to get any better. So, it's just a question of how much worse it's going to get. Yeah. There's going to be a lot of social tensions. I mean, we're going to see a much more visible presence of the security forces in most of these countries this year, I'm sure. There's going to be some sacrifices offered up on the part of, you know, their government is going to have to find some officials that they can point to and say, this guy is responsible for a lot of the people's problems. We've already seen this happening in Turkmenistan. It's going to happen across the board. So you're going to have some sacrificial lambs out there that hopefully will keep the masses quiet for a while. You know, really, it comes back to what I said. There's you know, people always say these people rule with an iron fist, but even they understand that there's a basic level that has to be preserved for the people. There has mm-hmm. to be certain foods that are available and that can't be too expensive, and there has to be a certain amount of electricity and heating and stuff that's available. And even if you can keep it there's a minimum that you can reach, but you can't go below a certain point before you're going to have social problems. And how much you're going to be able to quiet people off by giving them something temporarily, it depends on how much the government, I suppose, would even have to do it. There's no doubt about it. The regimes are going to take a hit as far as their what popularity they have anyway, I suppose, is going to diminish by the end of this year. I would imagine none of them will be anywhere near as popular, and that's a strange way of saying it. They'll be less popular than they are now, and that's not very popular. You know, Kazakhstan, look at this election. It's just a show. Like I said, this is a distraction that's coming up. They'll probably ferret out some people that will end up being, you know, the sacrifices later and say, well, this guy's out of government now, and he's actually one of the ones that resisted policies that would have helped you. So things are going to get worse. Popularity, the ruling elite's popularity is going to go down even more, and the security forces are going to be at the ready for the whole year to put down any potential flashpoints, because they don't want this stuff to break out, and they certainly don't want it to spread.
Right. Thank you, Bruce Panier, for your insightful thoughts. Alec Nice, regional analyst at London-based Economic Intelligence Unit, and Nate Schenken, project director in Nations in Transit at Freedom House. Thank you, gentlemen, for your thoughts and participation in the Majlis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.